In the Russia-Ukraine war, the city of Pokrovsk has taken center stage for quite some time now. We've been talking about this literally for months, how it was the Russian center of gravity and their priority of effort in the entire Eastern Front. And we've been chronicling how it's been going more and more into the red area, less and less into the Ukraine gold area. And now then we could literally be days or maybe a couple of weeks away from the final fall of the city. And that can have all kinds of ramifications. But as we've been talking about, that's what's going on there, because a lot of focus has been on that. But that's not the only battle going on the Eastern Front. We're going to talk about a really kind of an update with one of the best experts that we have on the show here. And we're really grateful to have back with us again today, Andrei Mardyanov, a veteran author and Russian military expert and host of the YouTube channel Smoothie X12. Andrei, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure, Danny.
Always love to have you on the show anyway, because your views are, you always have insights that we just don't get from any other source, especially American sources. And so we're always grateful for that. And, you know, this issue with Pokrovsk is one of the big ones here. And before we get into an actual detail of the battlefield itself, I'm going to pull the map up there and show people just how much continued advancement the Russian side has been doing. I want to show you kind of where President Trump is in all of this. And he was asked on Air Force One yesterday, kind of where he thought things were in terms of how's this going to end?
What happens is, I guess, Europe and Russia are having discussions. I'm not involved in those discussions.
Will you add long-range Tomahawk missiles? Is that something that you're not considering that?
No, not really.
Is it going to happen on Friday?
If it happened, I could change, but at this moment, I'm not. There's no final straw. Sometimes you have to let it fight out. They're fighting it out. It's been a tough war for Putin. He's lost a lot of soldiers, maybe a million. That's a lot of soldiers. And it's been tough for Ukraine. It's been tough for both. Sometimes you have to let it, you know, just get bought out, you know.
I just wonder what your off the hand reaction is. And I know there's a lot of things you said there, but let's zero in on the last part there. Is that, well, you know, sometimes you just got to let them fight it out. I mean, all of his whole thing from the beginning has been, I want to stop the killing. I want to end this war. Let's get a diplomatic solution. Let's have a ceasefire. Let's all. And then now, you know what? Just let them fight it out. What does Russia make of that?
Russians, we've been discussing with you and Gary for a while, this whole situation. Russians were giving off ramp to the United States practically the first day of Trump administration. Obviously, he is under pressure. Make no mistake, we understand his cognitive faculties are not as they used to be. But he understood the futility of pretending, actually, that he can do something to stop it and gain some political capital from it. For Trump, Russia is not a friend. But he understood if it continues like this, first, United States have been thoroughly demilitarized, and he can simply do nothing. I mean, this whole PR with Tomahawks, it's just so nauseating now. Everybody's like yawning anymore because they cannot take this anymore. It's boring people to death, you know. So, and what's left for him, he could have done it earlier. For whatever reasons, personal reasons, his narcissism, his, you know, the desire to get whatever, Nobel Peace Prize, for pressure from neocons, you know, and AIPAC and all those people, you know, he has to finally, you know, admit that United States doesn't have resources. It is not of the goodness of his heart. It is the fact which my video will come out of, you know, in an hour once we're done, that in the end, you have to look at the mathematics of the war. And the United States cannot support anymore this war. So that is why he does what he was supposed to be doing, let's say in February, March, when Russians were really like giving United States the off-ramp. Just take it, take it, take it. You know, the Putin, Lavrov, everybody were they're dealing with this. And instead of he got himself this moron General Kellogg as his special, you know, advisor, the guy has no clue about modern operations or anything. And so here we are. And now he has to literally wash his hands off, but he could have gotten out with much bigger political capital if he would have done it earlier. Now it is all about Europe. It is all about the decline of Europe and United States, as I state for many years, United States wants to eat too, you know. And between the two, Europe and United States, obviously United States has to, for all its internal problems, choose itself, you know. So simple as that. Europe is going to be, and it is being, as we speak, being brought to the altar as the sacrificial lamb. And in the larger strategic context, what can I say? United States chose, and through a Trump administration, to do it this way. And now, when we know what is happening in Pokrovsk just a couple hours ago, more than 85% of the city is controlled by Russians. And essentially, their bottleneck in Mirnograd have been closed. So we're looking, and there was a correction on the number of armed forces of Ukraine troops there. It is up to 9,000 there. Some very important American people are caught inside there. So there is a lot of things which are going on the line of the combat contact. And it's the only place which really influences everything what is being said on the highest political tribunes, including from the point of view of Trump himself. And somebody obviously told him that that's it. We cannot go on like this anymore. And it's probably for the better.
And he mentioned there at the first that where he said, well, that's between Ukraine and Russia and Europe, et cetera. What he was talking about was the claim that Europe is going to say, hey, let's seize Russia's assets that they've been talking about for a long time. They say, no, let's actually go ahead and do it right now. And so Trump is just like, I'm not even going to mess with that. What do you make of that situation? Because they've been talking about it for literally years and on and off for the last several months. Do you think that they're going to do it? And actually, why have they hesitated so far?
Well, I mean, today, Corriere della Sera, the main newspaper, you know, of Italy, suddenly writes about the fact that France, Germany, and Italy are against seizing those assets. And you have to remember, you probably remember this, the initial number which they were giving, they were $300 billion, okay, that they were supposed to seize. Now it's down to 140. First, the logical question is, where are those $160 billion? Well, Elvira Nabiullina, the chief of the Central Bank of Russia, she knows. And basically, Russians obviously have been able to withdraw those $160 billion. And so if they will do this, and that's what Corriere della Sera stated today, that it's going to be catastrophic action ramifications for the European financial system, you know? And that is why United States doesn't mind if it can get the, you know, piece of action, but only when it has the buffer zone or, you know, with those Europeans. And that's the last straw, so to speak, for them. Not that money will do any good for them to start with, but at least to support the existence of the Ukrainian government, or basically terrorist regime, because essentially the only reason Zelensky regime exists today is because of the financing provided by the combined West. And the combined West pays the salaries of his, you know, henchmen. It pays salaries to Verkhovna Rada. It pays salaries and some salaries to some people in Ukraine. So it basically prevents it to completely imploding. But you know what? Again, it's the kind of, you know, the drowning man grasp at the last straw. Even if to imagine that somehow they, you know, steal those funds, which it is, and which London wants to, it's not going to change anything except for completely ruin their financial, basically, reputation, whatever is left of it, of Europe. And after that, Europe is done pretty much in every single economic term. And like Qatar today, if you basically what we look today at what is happening around the world, we are seeing accelerated implosion, especially of the European economy, European political structures, and basically disintegration of the European NATO and EU. And in this case, you know, Russians say, try, you know, and see what's going to happen, because Russians have at about $1 trillion worth of the European assets on the territory of Russia. And Russia have been very clear about it. You take those remaining 140, you're not coming back to Russia at all. And they want to come back to Russia because many people do not know that actually Europeans are actively involved in behind the closed doors with all kinds of things, you know, just trying to get back on the Russian market because it's, you know, their chance, the last chance, because now they have totally, you know, uncompetitive, basically economies. Minister of the Economy of Germany, a week ago, she opens it where it seems to be a competitive economy. That's all about energy. Everybody knows that it's all about energy. Well, except for people who are Greens, you know, and
But let's look at that. That's a whole issue with the energy, because how is that playing out right now? Trump put sanctions on Russia, said this is going to be the biggest sanctions we've ever done, which I'm not sure that it was, but that's what he said because he loves things over the top. But two big oil companies and lots of reports, at least in the West, have said that it's not going to cripple Russia, but it is going to hurt a little bit. How is that? Let me ask you two questions. We'll start with the Russian side. How has that actually affected Russia negatively so far?
Well, somewhat, not really that big of a deal. And I can defer only to Larry Johnson, who just came back from Moscow. And he wrote a piece that Russia is not dependent on the international trade. Main resources for energy trade for Russians are obviously China and other countries in Southeast Asia. And if you listen to Mr. Novak, who used to be this genius, this, you know, mover and shaker behind Russian energy. He is now first vice deputy prime minister. He stated about a week ago, it said, the turning of the Russian energy supply streams towards Asia has been complete. Europe doesn't factor anymore, or United States for that matter, which, by the way, buys Russian oil, does not factor anymore in Russian budget and, you know, profits. And as Larry correctly stated, Russians do not depend on that. Only 17%. Some people say it's only 13% of a Russian budget comes from the trade in the hydrocarbons. The rest of it is completely domestic thing. Russia is self-sufficient. It's the only country in the world which can literally live as autarky because Russia has everything. From energy to rare earth metals to what have you, you know, ores and things of this nature, which, by the way, is one of the major impetuses behind Europeans' hatred of Russians because, you know, they look at those Slavic subhumans. How the hell did they end up sitting on the more than one third of the natural resources of the planet? You know, and that's what doesn't give them, you know, just any kind of the reason to calm down and stop this, what they are doing. And that's what is happening. So how could it reflect? Well, maybe a couple rubles higher on the per liter on the gas stations. But even that is not necessarily true.
And let's look at the other half of that equation, because two of the biggest users were two of the three biggest users in the European side were Hungary, Slovakia, and I think maybe Czech Republic. I can't remember the third one, but those other two were certainly, and at least in the previous months, just the last few months, Viktor Orban and Robert Fico have been emphatic about, we are not going to stop buying Russian oil. Has these new sanctions against the Russian oil companies forced them to not buy oil from Russia?
They may. I mean, do not forget, they are still there. Part of the EU, they are small countries, relatively small countries. But that also opened the other can of worms, if you know it. You've read the news, obviously, as well as me. Now, suddenly, Fico and Orban, they say, oh, no, we're going to create the coalition of the Eastern European countries, which will be totally against supporting Ukraine, which, of course, is the ramification of all that, also somehow opening the door to what actually their countries exist on. It's, you know, it depends on Russian energy. And not only nuclear, for example, Russians obviously build the nuclear power station in Hungary, but they understand that their livelihood depends on that. They can see now what is happening in the Western Europe. They are not stupid people. They are shrewd politicians, courageous people, Viktor Orban and Fico. And so who knows? I had a joke like 2 days ago. I said, you know, why don't they go out and recreate Austro-Hungarian Empire, for crying out loud? And at least, you know what, and say, well, screw this EU thing, which, you know, but then again, we are looking right now, this very minute, at the implosion of EU as such. And that is why this agony about Russian funds, because they know once they're, you know, do something about it, it's over. You know, it's over. I mean, de jure, not just de facto, which it is now. And so what can I say? I mean, but again, they are important part of Russian supply, and Russians honor those contracts which expire by 2027, I believe. All those contracts have been signed till the end of the 2027. After that, Europe has nothing left. I mean, and we know European countries such as Finland or Germany, they all together said, screw contracts, we just don't buy it. Okay. Russia said, okay, turned around, and they go to China, which is the other third superpower, economic superpower, who says, we don't care, we just buy it. They can do whatever they want. We're just buying this energy. And now the power of Siberia, too, have been adopted, you know, and I mean, the agreement have been signed. And things of this nature are happening all over the place. And Indians, well, in typical Indian manner, say, yeah, we're probably going to follow this, but we will still assess this in favor of the Indian national interest. What is Indian national interest? The Rosneft has number of gigantic refineries there, which obviously works to the benefit both of Russia and Indians. I doubt that India really wants to lose that. And they already have been saying this. And then suddenly now you have this. That's the whole point. We have to look at the whole picture. We suddenly have this, it's a shocking development for the international, aerospace, commercial aerospace industry. Hindustan, main HAL, that's how it's called, HAL, state-owned aerospace company, suddenly signed a memorandum, and they're going to be doing this joint venture for producing all the Sukhoi superjets, which are totally Russian now, in India. They need at least 200 to 300 those things for their internal market. It's a shocker. For Embraer or Airbus 220, it's like, uh-oh, we screwed up, you know. And so that's what is happening. We cannot now grasp all of those ramifications, so to speak, of what is going on. And so that is why Russians are pretty nonchalant about, I mean, they do their proper due, you know, formal due, like issuing their statements and things like that. But if Europe wants to appropriate those $140 billion, that will be over for Europe, and Russians have about $1 trillion of the Western assets right now in Russia, and they will be basically nationalized. For now, they are in the special mode. I don't remember how it is called, so it's kind of like holding a pattern. So it says, oh, okay, it's your thing, we're using it, but at some point of time, if things work out, you come back and you own it again. Not anymore. If it happens, it's over.
Yeah, and I want to shift a little bit to the battlefield, or at least the support to the battlefield. We're going to get to Pokrovsk here in just a second, but that Gary, if you can put that headline back up you just had a second ago, because Ukraine has gotten more U.S. made air defense systems to counter Russian attacks. I also saw earlier today that the UK has sent more Storm Shadow missiles to Ukraine. And one just has to wonder, when you see the financial issues starting to fall apart, when you hear President Trump say, you know what, maybe they just got to fight it out, you see what's physically happening. Why in the world, what is the national interest for any of these countries that were providing those Patriot systems to just throw more of them into the garbage can and more Storm Shadows, potentially risking the ire of Russia, but at the best case scenario, just having no impact on anything? Why would they do that?
In England today, my good friend Irina Arsnes, chief editor of RIA News, she wrote an excellent piece. For example, for England, it's already out desperation and envy. British just envy Russia, considering their pathetic state their country is in. And so it's historical in nature. Others, Germans, for the most part, they don't like Russians, you know. So they do it out of spite. And yeah, it's not going to change anything. It doesn't matter. United States can provide, or whoever can provide, whatever the patriots they want. They are useless. 6% effectiveness. It's the not estimates, assessment of the former deputy chief of general staff of Ukraine, not Russians. That's Ukrainians are saying this. So, and it's all about spite. It's all about pretending that they somehow know how to fight. They don't. And it's like this defense minister of Belgium who offered to wipe off Moscow off the face of the earth. And then he was scared so much that he suddenly turned around, you know, 180 degrees or 360 degrees per Annalena Baerbock. And he suddenly now he had nervous breakdown, you know, so because of the statement. So that's the kind of people you have there. They're morons. They hate Russian gods. And that's why they're doing this. It's, and because if you look attentively at those totalitarian regimes, we can say it now very specifically who they are. The London, Berlin, Paris are totalitarian regimes. They are regimes. They pretend to be dictators. They suppress every remnant of the freedom of expression, of the political opinion, what have you. So for them, they are literally, well, Macron, last time I checked, he had what, support rating of like 11%? He will be probably 3%, which is the error margin in the that's what is happening. And but then again, you cannot also deny the traditional, like it is case in Poland or Germany, hatred or dislike of Russians among at least majority of population. How large is majority? I don't know, but it's majority. It's 60-65% at least. So, and when you have those people and you look at Netherlands and things of this nature, so they will be throwing bad money, you know, good money after the bad ones, and it's not going to change anything. But yeah, how many storm shadows can Britain provide in the practical terms? 20? Okay, so it's a standard target for Russian air defense complexes and air defense, which is actually improving constantly. So yeah, they will try to do some PR thing. That's the only thing they can do. They will try to again to blow the Crimean bridge. They will try to do some terrorist act and strike Russian apartment complexes because London hates Russian gods. I mean, they abhor Russians. You know, they don't mind killing children, women. You know, that's what they do. And so when you look at this summary, so to speak, of the whole things, though, that's exactly how the disintegration looks like. Because obviously it doesn't make any sense in any, any sense in any practical, from the practical point of view. But they don't know what war is. They don't understand warfare. None of them, with few exceptions, for example, in Brussels NATO headquarters, understand strategic thinking. They don't understand how it's done. And we saw from the point of view of the operational planning, how they do it. It's a catastrophe.
Well, and in fact, let's take a look at that. So I mentioned at the outset we were going to look at the what's going on the battlefront, and I just want people to keep in mind as we move to this. This is, we are now closing in. We're not far away from the fourth year, the completion of the fourth year of this war. We have tried everything in the world, especially in late 2022 and all of 2023 from the West, to saturate Ukraine with an offensive capability. It utterly failed in the most horrific way possible, completely broke their teeth. And ever since that time, they have been going backwards. Now then, on top of all that, on top of all the things that have done, all the money, this is where we are right now. And I want to start off here a little bit. This is the Pokrovsk area. I want to go a little bit south of that because this is something that not a lot of people in the West are aware of. This is the Dnipropetrovsk region right here, these red lines. And you see that there's a lot of Russian red on the other side of that borderline. Yeah. And here around Novopavlivka, there's Russians have gotten right up to the edge of the outskirts of this town here. And I wonder if you could just tell us what are the Russians doing in this oblast? Because it's not just the four anymore. Now there's here growing areas of Dnipropetrovsk.
It is done under the auspices of the what is called the buffer zone or security zone. And it was stated by Mr. Putin and by Mr. Lavrov many times, who say, when we will decide what is the satisfactory buffer zone, we will stop. You know, but obviously, the whole notion of the buffer zone, or at least the, let's put it this way, the argument about the buffer zone is such that we have to move further into the Ukrainian proper territory for now in order to prevent the attacks by all kinds of like things like HIMARS, you know, and things of this nature. So to basically make the living at the border regions of the new Russian territories, new oblast, safe. And that is exactly what is happening. And yes, it's not only Dnipropetrovsk. We have to keep in mind that essentially the operation on the liberation of Kherson has already started. It's just a matter of Russians doing it again in a very deliberate, slow manner, because the main point is to break the back of everything what's left there. And if you look attentively at Karantinny Ostrov, Russian DRGs, the Diversionary Recon Groups, have been going there, like, you know, to work, you know. And this is like literally 800 meters from the center of Kherson. And there are DRGs operating on the right bank of Dnieper. So it's all active. Zaporozhye is active front, and this is moving to the west. And as Mr. Medvedev today stated, listen, Mr. Medvedev is pretty, you know, he doesn't mince words. He says eventually all traditional historic Russian lands will return home. Okay, take it for whatever it is, you know. So, but now primarily it is all about killing off enemy. It is the, yes, very many Russians say, you wanted to fight it to the last Ukrainian, so be it. It will be to the last Ukrainian. And this is exactly what is happening.
Okay, so that's the Kherson area you were talking about just a second ago. But now let's go up to kind of to where everybody's talking right now, which could be one of the bigger important areas, and that is in Pokrovsk.
Yeah.
And so even in just the last 12 hours or so, there's been yet more Russian advances inside the city. Yeah. And you see now that there's basically just three small areas where they're still under Ukrainian control. And then here's Mirnograd over there. We'll talk about that separately. What's going on here in Pokrovsk, and how are they literally within maybe 2 or 3 weeks of total collapse?
We have to, I don't know the time frame. It's in terms of real total collapse, but 85% of Pokrovsk this morning, confirmation, are controlled by Russian troops. They are packed, the remnants, either packed into their civilian quarters, and that's what they do. Very popular thing. They hide behind civilians. This is what they do. And so not much left for them. So now there are visuals and information coming from them starting to, surrendering in some significant numbers. But others, more fanatical or drugged, run to Mirnograd, you know, where they will be killed, all of them, if they do not surrender. And that's what is happening. And now we know the number there, up to 9,000. So essentially, which are still surviving there. So essentially, you have, by the time it started in earnest, in terms of the surrounding this grouping, we're looking at the, divisions do not exist anymore in Ukrainian military, but we had there about the equivalent of two divisions. So give and take 5-6 brigade, probably more, trapped inside. And now we have the situation with those GUR operations, hustles, if you wish. So the situation is dire. The bottleneck, I will speak, my video comes up after we finished here. I speak about this bottleneck. It's about 1 kilometer, wide, which is controlled
by
this.
This one right here, the one in between. Yeah,
it's less. Yeah, it's about 1 kilometer. Yeah, it's completely sealed off, and now they try to save themselves in Mirnograd, but it's not going to help, and yeah, it's going to end up very badly for everybody there. But at least those who are surrendering, they are surprised because they are brainwashed, because they think Russians are going to kill them. They are given the medical treatment, fed, given water, and they say very interesting thing, those POWs. there is a huge issue with drinking water in Mirnograd right now. They said that actually the thirst is horrendous, you know. So, well, it is classic cauldron, you know. What can I say? Not the first one, probably not the last one.
Yeah.
And Gerasimov and Russian field generals, commanders of those groupings on operational axis, they're masters of the cauldrons, and they just do it the way to preserve mostly the lives of Russian soldiers.
Right. One thing I want to talk about here a little bit, because I know you and I were talking about this a little bit before we came on the air here. And in the last 24 hours or so, there have been reports, and apparently it could have come back as long as the 29th of October. There were some U.S. Blackhawks, or at least U.S. procured Blackhawks, did some special operations insertion. I think it was in this area right here. There was one that was some video that was shown of the insertion, and apparently video showing two separate Blackhawks in flight. So we don't know what happened to those. What can you tell us about these Blackhawks?
Well, I mean, we would assume that these were Americans who were flying them. Actually, there were two insertion so-called operations with the creme de la creme or whatever is left of the special forces of GUR, which is essentially GUR, which is the intelligence agency of the Ukrainian Defense Ministry, is essentially the outlet of CIA. And Larry Johnson, he's absolutely correct. I can confirm that basically there are some big CIA paras there. But the problem so there were three Black Hawks. There are two of them down. I believe one was destroyed on the ground. The other was shut down trying to escape. The other one turned around. And so the couple of the, actually one major, another captain, I believe, don't quote me on that. But one of major of these forces, special forces, have been taken prisoner of war. And so information is they are searching for some big CIA people there. And the only way for these CIA people is to escape probably right now, because they are blocked, is probably towards Mirnograd if they somehow try to escape. If not, they will be either killed or captured. And that's simple as that. And that is why so much panic and desperation on part of basically suicide missions. This is
let me ask you that. I mean, I actually have conducted some of these helicopter inserted special operations missions while I was on one particular mission in Afghanistan. And, you know, that is something that was wired very tight. We had lots of support in the air and all kinds of other overhead support should we need it here. There's none of that here. So what in the world would go into even launching such a mission like this? What possible benefit could it do to Ukraine?
Well, there's no benefit. And people who plan those, first, you have to understand CIA and people from NATO staffs, American, British, whatever. For them, Ukrainians are cannon fodder. They are subhumans. They throw them in. They don't care how many of them killed. Plus, as you said, it is one thing what you were doing in Afghanistan. In there, as you can see yourself, this is all Russians seeing it 24/7. Every minute, every movement is controlled. And it all just a matter of the RUK, what is called a recon strike and recon fire complex, how Russians react and what do they do in terms of, for example, do they want to kill all group? No. The first group which was there, you can see there are videos of them. They, out of 11 people, 8 have been killed immediately. And others have been basically, you know, taken. And whatever their counter insertion operation done on Russian side, they are very good level professionals and they have their full tactical and situational awareness of the area. And that's why we know it now for sure. The search is for those big CIA hunches, you know, paramilitaries. And as I already stated, it's doubtful that they can escape. So they either will be taken prisoners or will be killed or maybe will commit suicide. So it's just the way it is.
It's just hard for me to fathom. But doing something like this, the mission I was on, for example, it was about two or three Taliban people that our group was supposed to be going after. But I mean, this was just the edge of a huge battlefield that you're already on the lower side. So I don't even know what the objective would be? What would they even be saying to try and accomplish other than
They are incompetent. That's the whole point. This is the point.
It's just hard for me to imagine that level of incompetence.
Easily. I spoke to people like Brandon Weikert. He was a professional congressional staffer, and he played the Pentagon games. He confronted what we know. Most of the intel, for example, a Pentagon receives is from Kiev. So it's not intel, it's propaganda. And only few people, and obviously some colonels and brigadier generals who sit in the operational planning departments, which doesn't matter what they say. You literally have people who, I give you one example. There are morons, you know what, with the senior ranks in, for example, Institute of the Study of the Modern War from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. They really believe that Patriot Pac-3 can shoot down hypersonic targets. They do believe it. You know why? Because Ukrainians told them. And those guys, they sit there, they get this garbage in, and they make, look at our, prowess, and they still do not understand. Operationally, they are amateurs. This has been going on for years, and they have to understand what side they're dealing with.
There doesn't seem to be, but I want to kind of drive home something I mentioned at the outset of this, that Pokrovsk is in the headlines right now and just making all kinds of news for reasons that are not good for the Ukraine side, but it's not the only one. So we've already talked about Dnipropetrovsk. This is the Pokrovsk area. I want to go over here to Konstantinivka. Because there's also been Russia's continued now moving actually in the outskirts of Konstantinivka. What can you tell us about this? Because this one is not in a semi cauldron here. Where is this from the Russian perspective?
They maintain that the holding force, which absolutely is not going to go there for now and in an active way, as it is done in Kupiansk, and now is happening actually at Seversk. It's a classic operational stretching. The holding force, which attracts some force of the whatever is remaining armed forces of Ukraine in order to stretch them on other operational axes. And other operational axes is what? There's Kupiansk, obviously, and now Seversk. Seversk is being surrounded as we speak. So it's basically pinning down the force. Classic, operational art 101.
So here's Seversk. What's happening right here?
Yeah, Seversk, yeah. Seversk is, it's actually the map changed dramatically since, I don't know whose map is that, but now Seversk is being surmised, getting ready to be operationally surrounded. Not tactically, but operationally, that means that all of the exits will be fire controlled by Russian troops. And that's another thing which is going to be happening. And it is all about essentially finishing off, as I already stated, that it's all about killing the enemy, period. It's physical annihilation of the force. It's not just about territory. Yes, one of the greatest Russian and Soviet strategists, Alexander Svechin wrote in his fundamental treatise from 1927, which is called Strategy. Surprise, surprise. He said that, taking the ground is necessary evil. Which you need to accomplish by achieving your main objective of the physical annihilation of the enemy force. And this is exactly what happens. But that's this completely differs from the so-called strategic school of thought or whatever is left of it in NATO countries. They still believe that running, getting those, square mileage somehow defines your success. No. And the strategists and general staff, they don't think like that. But that's what I was trying to, I wrote 4 books on it. I'm writing now 5 books, 5th book, on that. This is not how war works, but again, they never learned any lessons from the Eastern Front in World War II. And as a result, we have this situation and they still look at it and say, it's slow. No, it is not, because every day, if you look attentively at today's tally, yet again, almost 1,500 killed KIAs of the Ukrainian armed forces. And basically, until they run completely out of mobilizational resource, which they are near it. That's it.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to that in just a second. But here in the last one I want to look at is Kupiansk. And when you zero in here, you can see, again, most of the city's already in red, and there's not that much on this side that's still left in the gold of the Ukraine side. What can you tell us about what's happening here?
Oh, I mean, if you look attentively again, the bottleneck, if you look, it's the, you know, yes, the extremities, that means the fire operational surrounding, it's fire control of this bottleneck. This is what Russians do. They love to control lines of communication because you have to, again, operational art 101. And so, yeah, you can try to escape on foot, as many do, but the only thing you have left is basically suffer from hunger, from thirst, and you have the option, go and surrender. If not, they will try, as you can see yourself, two highways, not highways really, one of them is railroad. They will try to you know, escape. They will be killed while escaping, and still they will be corralled and, you know, made to surrender or will be killed. It's all simple as that. In war, you have to kill the enemy, and that's the simple truth of it.
And you mentioned about the human capital, how much the Ukraine side has that's going down. They are actually bleeding, not just on the battlefield, but over their borders. This report here, it was in some of the British newspapers and was reported here on X by Yulia Mendel, who was the former, speaker of the for the Zelensky regime before she resigned. And she says almost 100,000 fighting age Ukrainian men have left the country in just the past 2 months after Zelensky eased departure rules. Poland's border guard said 99,000 Ukrainian men aged between 18 and 22 had crossed the frontier, the primary route out of the country, since regulations to ensure that Kiev had enough soldiers were relaxed at the end of August. And then she says, she makes this comment here, in comparison, the entire British army has around 70,000 active duty personnel here, and 100,000 have left in just the last 2 months. And then you add on top of that, I think I saw a report, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, that said somewhere around 500,000 Ukraine soldiers had deserted at one point or another in this calendar year alone. And then now then there's more and more insufficient numbers of forced mobilization. It's just, and now then you add on top of that everything you just mentioned about the literal casualties every day, killed and wounded on the battlefield. It just doesn't seem like Ukraine can survive much longer.
Well, I mean, correct, by the way, yeah, Deutsche Welle, Germany, by the way, now cutting off their those benefits, free money, basically, you know, for Ukrainian refugees. And that's the result of their activities of NATO and Zelensky regime, who is a puppet of people from Brussels and Washington, D.C. They wanted it. They observe it. They complicit in the annihilation of the Ukrainian nation, of the Ukrainian man. And basically why they, how to say it, is the escape for the 18 and 22-year-olds. 18-year-old is just a kid, you know. It's not really fighting man. You even to turn the 18-year-old kid into the fighting man, you need at least a couple of years, you know, to turn him into the some kind of the real military material. So it's the saving of the sperm bank of Ukrainian nation. That's the only reason, because at some point of time, this is how CIA thinks, this is how so-called strategists in Pentagon think, that, we need to save somebody to give the birth, as they were saving the Benderite and Nazi collaborators, moving them from Great Britain to Canada and to United States. And that's pretty much the same plan. The problem is that it doesn't matter what they do. It's not those methods, so to speak. They are very, very uncultured and limited in their worldview people. They constantly try to repeat some pattern like it was during the Cold War 1.0. This is not it. And the problem is, as Mr. Medvedev stated, you continue to do more of that, more territories will come to Russia. Simple as that. with the population. And we, again, as Pokrovsk demonstrated, yet again, obviously hidden from the Western public by the mainstream media, they hide behind civilians now. They always did. Just today, investigative committee of Russia returned remnants of 300 bodies of women, children, old men, civilians in Kursk Oblast to their relatives. They have been executed by the Ukrainian forces. Women have been raped. Children were used as their live targets. This is West's responsibility. And while we definitely talk a lot about Gaza and, you know, all things which is happening there, they don't understand that more than 2 million Ukrainian men have been slaughtered because of the plans of those people. So-called, you know, geniuses with Ivy League degrees, which are useless, you know, degree meals, but they thought that they know what they're dealing with. I wrote 11 years ago, it's on my blog. One of the first posts was saying, unleashing this hell in Ukraine, they don't understand what they're getting themselves into. They're going to lose big. And this is exactly how it happened, because they essentially poked Russia where they were not supposed to do it. I am pretty much, you know, outspoken on this issue. And those people, you know, until the new generation of the politicians in the United States and possibly doubt it, but still in Europe emerges, these people committed their crime against humanity. They just do not want to admit it, but they will. It's inevitable.
And Gary keeps showing headline after headline here. This is, you know, not any kind of propaganda. This is just news that are across the board from all sides here talking about what's happening. And the battlefield says what it does. Before I let you go today, I want to ask you a couple other kind of related things. And we're going to look at, we showed you earlier something President Trump said aboard Air Force One yesterday on this issue here with the Russia-Ukraine war. He had some other things to say, too. And he was talking about more from the strategic point of view, how he believes that his use of tariffs is providing national security for the United States of America.
Without tariffs, without our being able to use tariffs freely, openly, and in every way, we are really would suffer tremendously from a national security standpoint. Other countries use tariffs against us. If we weren't able to openly and freely use tariffs against them, I'll give you an example, China. That was going to be a disaster for the world, and I was able to settle it very quickly, very easily, because I was able to use tariffs. It's total national security. And economic health is also part of national security, by the way. But without tariffs, our country would be in great jeopardy.
Wow. I mean, who knew that he made China all afraid of by using these tariffs? Maybe you've already answered the question, but what say you?
I mean, the real national security threat to the United States is a Wall Street and financial system, which is run by crooks. It's so that's the national security threat. China, he met with Xi for 1 hour, 40 minutes. And he looked like the beaten, you know, boy after this meeting. And considering the fact that obviously you have interpreters working there. So out of those 1 hour, 40 minutes, probably 1 hour was basically the interpreters delivering, you know, their translation to respective leaders. So it tells you pretty much everything you need to know, that China doesn't give China already can, which already they did, they can remove the access to the rare earth metals or, you know, resources. And they can open this valve when they want. They can close it when they want. And again, many people do not understand. China's real economy is gigantic. It is so much larger than American one that it's difficult to even to explain that you cannot scare China other than playing around with the shipping lanes of communications, which are critical for China. For example, Indian lanes of communications, which are critical for the more than 25% of the energy supplied from the Middle East and Iran to China. And you have to force China constantly in some kind of the position where it has to mind those things. Because, well, United States Navy is still around. And it's, God forbid, of course, if it goes down to this way, this path. But so it is all game. But China, you cannot scare them, really. You know, you can threaten the shipping lanes of communications, but we already see what is happening. The all more main supply lines are being moved or already are in or being moved inside the Eurasian landmass from Russia to China. And, of course, the Arctic route suddenly, you know, Chinese are sending now the, you know, their things there. And they get, the, for example, liquefied natural gas from Novatek's facilities, which are at the Sabetta port, in the, which is also covered by Russian icebreakers, nuclear icebreakers, and forces of the Northern and Pacific fleet of Russia. So it's like, okay, so try to, you know, and then, of course, there is another thing which everybody knows, and nobody wants to talk about it. Dollar is now irrelevant, essentially, in the payment systems.
Yeah, moving in the wrong direction as well. One interesting place where the tariffs have not been very effective, even in Trump's telling, and that is in Venezuela.
We'll see what happens with Venezuela. Venezuela sent us thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people from prisons, from mental institutions, drug addicts, and so did other countries. That's the bad. I mean, other countries did it too, because we were run by very stupid people, very, very stupid people. Biden was the worst president in the history of our country by far. We had open borders, and many countries, the Congo, many countries, they sent their prisoners. They sent prisoners. They sent drug dealers. They sent drug addicts. They sent anybody, anybody that they didn't want, they sent them through our country. And Venezuela was one of the worst abusers.
I don't know. Maybe I've been spending so much time with the Russia-Ukraine war and the Middle East and things that are going on there. Maybe I missed hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan crazy institutions flooding into America. Did I miss something?
Me too. I mean, obviously, I'm missing something. However, there is a certain truth to his. That's the problem with Trump. Sometimes he inadvertently says some things which are at least partially true. There is no doubt that, for example, drug cartels, especially from Mexico and other Central American countries, they are infiltrating the United States. As many people now say, their money and influence is even on the Capitol Hill, which is not surprising. It's just the matter, or most of those congressmen and senators are for sale, so they don't care whom they sell themselves to. But our point is obviously, Venezuelans, hundreds of thousands mental and drug addicts. This is the first time I heard about it. MS-13, that's the whole other story. But, I mean, he invents all kinds of the justifications. And so what can I say? He is preparing some kind of the regime change or sort of attempted it. All the Tulsi Gabbard stated 2 days ago that the regime change policies are over. We'll see. I mean, the United States moves some assets, including to Puerto Rico now. Well, they may try to launch something at Venezuela. I doubt there will be any kind of the serious action on the ground, except for the special forces. That's about it. And that's it. The United States has no resources to really fight the war in the country, which is, by the way, three times the size of the area of Vietnam. It's jungle, mountains, rivers, and as Doug McGregor correctly stated, there's 100,000 of Colombians there sitting on the border waiting for to get into if, God forbid, something happens to Venezuela, you know. And so it's all posturing at now, but that's as far as I know. You know, I'm not a specialist in Latin America. I definitely have no any insights there. I just look at the moving of the assets to Puerto Rico and around, you know. So, but most likely what it's going to be, the best we can observe, God forbid, even that goes there. It's some kind of launching of the, you know, Tomahawks, than inserting some seals, whatever. That's about it. You know.
Well, and that's what I actually wanted to ask your opinion about, because, I mean, you obviously studied the art of war, not even just in specific locations. And if you see that amount of firepower that we have in there, and it's relatively, I mean, it's big in one sense, but it's really small in another sense when you're talking about a country the size of Venezuela that you just mentioned there. When you see that number of assets, what is even possible militarily? I mean, something like a special operations to go in where, I mean, I don't know. Do you think that there's even the theoretical possibility they could do a snatch and grab on Maduro himself?
Well, they probably will try. I will be very sorry for people who would try to do this. But there is another thing. Yeah, I see you showing this map from Reuters. Yeah, they move some assets. But again, in order to remember, we had the Vietnam War. By the end of Vietnam War, there were more than 600,000 American troops on the ground. And that, and still it didn't get anywhere near to proper, you know, what victory or even achieving any tangible political aims. United States can launch things. United States has about 2.5 U.S. Navy, 2,500 of the Tomahawks of the Block 4 and 5 variety, which are the most advanced, albeit it's an old missile anyway. Yeah, they can launch whatever, 2,000 Tomahawks within some period of time. Guess what's going to happen? U.S. Navy will simply run out of the Tomahawks. And the world will be pointing out to the United States, look what you're doing. You're just bombing, you know, the country which is not, does not represent any real serious threat to you. That's it.
And what are we to make of this big Russian transport that was seen in Caracas here recently? What do we think might have been on board?
I don't know. They're difficult to say. Listen, there could have been just merely military advisors. You know, so IL-76 can take on board, well, obviously it can take on board a couple of companies of the paratroopers, but that's not the case here at all. It's either some kind of the advisory people, plus maybe some type of the hardware, whatever they were moving there. I would say, but again, this is not... don't quote me on that. This is pure speculation on my part. They can certainly transport number of the Yakhant, which are the shorter version of the P-800 Onyx anti-ship missiles, which under the what is called converter thing could be stuck on the... don't forget, Venezuela has about 21 Su-30 MK-2s. These are fairly modern fighters. This is not your Su-27. Those are modern for generation 4+ fighters, which are capable of carrying some really nasty weapons, such as which Venezuela does have, which is KH-31. And this is anti-shipping and anti-radiation missile with a range of 250 kilometers. But obviously, Yakhant, appearance of Yakhant, it's a direct threat to any kind of the large U.S. Navy asset. But I doubt that Russia actually transferred that. There could have been some hardware related to electronic warfare, maybe. Who knows? You know, I don't know. But maybe just simply military people who went there to organize defense.
Well, I guess we'll find out if that's something we discover later on. I actually hope we don't find out.
Let's hope there is no attack. Nobody needs that. No Venezuelans or American people should die, or American soldiers should die for that. That's pure, simple adventurism. It has 100%. No political or strategic sense other than, again, you know, the chest thumping thing. And so, yeah, let's hope that it goes nowhere. And, well, we'll see anyhow.
We will see. Well, listen, really appreciate you coming on today and especially giving us your views about what's going on the Russian side there and making it so clear about what the actual Russian objectives are and their strategic operations. So that's very, very helpful. Also, just to point people back, you mentioned a video coming out later today on Smoothie X12. People should go there and watch that online and they'll be able to see the thing. I'm sure I will do the same. So look forward to seeing that.
Thank you. Talk to you later, Danny. Bye-bye.
Talk to you later. Thank you very much. And be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that yet. And we will look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.